Thank you very much. So again, the idea with these titles is that it gets as many people into the room as possible. And then I get to beg off on everything I've said. But indeed, so it's in an essay published in 1960. Spoke about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics to the natural sciences. And in fact, at the end of that essay, he has a little remark where he says, he's talking mostly about physics, and he wonders if this kind of thing can be extended to biology. And Gelfand actually has sort of a comment on this, in which he says, well, when Wigner was talking about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences, he meant, of course, physics. And then he says the most, the only thing more unreasonable than this is the unreasonable ineffectiveness of mathematics in biology. So this is Gelfand, who knows a little bit about biology shortly after Wigner's paper. So just stepping back, so obviously what Wigner's point was that the way we discover mathematical truths is, you know, quite independent of physical law, and so it seems rather surprising that math has anything to say about physics at all, and let alone that it's just sort of the only way to discover physical truth these days. So it hints at something deep about the relationship between math and physics. Now, obviously biology comes out of physics and chemistry, and in that sense, now that we're all on the side of believing that math should play a role in physical truth, I agree that mathematics, of course, will be effective in explaining and discovering biology. I just claim that it's irrelevant. Okay, so that's okay. So, true biology. So that's the title of this talk: the unreasonable irrelevance of mathematics to biology. And again, in the same spirit as Wigner, so what I want to argue is that this indicates something about the way biology works. Okay? And so by the end of it, hopefully, I can remove the unreasonable irrelevance of mathematics to biology. And that way I save my career, because these things are recorded and everybody sees them. Okay. So the point is this. Look, biologists don't use mathematics on a day-to-day basis. We all know this. However, they're incredibly opportunistic. So biologists have been incorporating improvements in equipment and imaging and all kinds of things at a huge rate. Okay, so they're very opportunistic. They've used whatever it takes to discover biological truth. The fact that biologists don't use math is not primarily because biologists are averse to math or anything like that. If they needed to use math, they would. Okay, but for most of the problems biologists are interested in, a mathematical description would be a very, very long way to arrive at the truths which they discover using techniques of biology. Okay, so that's the idea. So it's irrelevant to the program of the bulk of biological research. Okay, and biologists are not constrained by their lack of mathematics so far, although we'll revisit this at the end of the talk. So to understand, so that's really the question: why is this so? It seems unreasonable to us because it's so good in physics. So to start off, I'm going to give you a little sort of crash course in biology as I understand it, with the, you know, apologies to the biologists in the audience. So I'll buy you all beer if you don't poke holes in my description of biology here. Okay? So the biology that we're going to discuss today, something called genotype. Okay, which of course you all know. DNA, the four-letter code, ATGC. The DNA in cells in our body contains the instructions to make the whole organism. This is true for all of life as we know it. But let's think for the moment of genotype as just some sort of string, ones and zeros, some sort of discrete code. You can think of DNA in this way, it's not too much of a stretch. And then there's something called the phenotype, which is the microscopic outcome of all the way this genotype is unpacked and decoded and made into proteins and cells talk to each other and make an organism, and in the end you get this big organism. So the way I would like to think of phenotype today is some sort of macroscopically observable traits of an organism that selection, natural selection in Darwin's sense, can act upon. So you could think, for example, of the height of an organism or its running speed, right? And one can imagine that these sort of macroscopic properties are things that selection can act upon. And a given organism would be a point in this phenotypic space. Now, going from here to here is all the crazy, intricate, you know, beautiful mechanism of biology. Right? This is what many people are trying to discover. But we'll leave that aside for the moment. So we have this sort of map. Just a word on how you should think about this. Of course, the vast majority of the letters, the majority of letters in our genome, if you change them, it won't change anything sort of measurable on the outside. And so we can sort of ignore those. And then there's another subset of letters which, if you change them, you'll just die. And so in some sense, we'll just ignore those. So this is a subset of letters on the DNA, which can lead to some sort of macroscopic outcome, not just death. And just so this doesn't get too abstract, we know that the DNA, which is these ATGC or ones and zeros, can actually be thought of as little bits which we call genes, which encode proteins. And then there's regions upstream of the genes, which are regulators, or regulatory regions, which control whether the gene is going to be turned on or off. So you can just sort of keep this in the back of your mind. Okay? But really, it's just the code, the ones and zeros that we're worried about. Also, just to introduce a few words here, which I might use later on. Can everybody see this side of me? Yeah? So I'm going to speak, okay, so instead of talking about genes, because genes encode proteins, there's more information on DNA than just genes, because there are these regions of the DNA that control whether genes are expressed or not, and they have as much effect on the macroscopic properties of an organism as the genes themselves. So it's more generally, the way you think about it as a geneticist, you would talk about something called the locus. The locus is sort of the address, a place on the DNA, and then you can talk about an allele. And an allele, in some sense, is the letter that actually exists at that locus. Okay, so you can think of loci, which are many places, alleles, which are sort of many options sitting at those loci. And we have genotype, we have phenotype. The genotype, in some sense, contains many loci, and the alleles at that loci, that's what the genotype is. Now, what can happen in biology? What are the processes that can happen that can perturb the genotype? There's only two that I'm interested in today. So one is the process of mutation. And mutation is an event where you take some sort of sequence, right, and you just change one of them. Okay, so that's a point mutation. There are more general ways to think about this, but that is irrelevant for today. And then there's another fairly important process called recombination. And recombination, what it does is it assorts alleles at different loci. So one simple way to think about it, if you have one organism with a string of ones in terms of its DNA, there's another organism with a string of zeros. That's right, and maybe through mating or some other sort of DNA meeting, pairing event, there's what's called a crossover. And what results from a process like this is you'll have ones at the beginning, you'll have zeros afterwards in one of the outcomes, and you have zeros at the beginning, and you have ones afterwards in the other outcome. Okay? So these are the two processes that can change the underlying genotype. And what this whole talk is about is how do these processes then manifest themselves at the level of phenotype. Okay? So if there are any questions about words, and I throw out any more technical words than these in the middle of the talk, to stop and interrupt me and say, what does that mean?
We're talking about an individual here, not a population.
Very good. So we'll have to think about both. So populations are populations of individuals. Mm-hmm. And in a population, at any given locus, there might be a variety of alleles that happen to exist. And they will then reassort by mating and so on. Yes?
Are the loci defined independently, like the millionth loci? Or are they defined with reference to the alleles that are present in your body?
Yeah, so very good, very good. So that's, I will answer that question later in the talk. So the question is how, so these are all operational. Geneticists had defined these things long before we even knew the structure of DNA. So how does genetics work? Genetics, not even genetics 101, but something much more primitive than that. How does genetics work? If you have some organism, let's say it's your fruit fly, which is everybody's favorite model organism, what you do is you can mutagenize it. So in other words, you take the DNA of one individual or a set of individuals and just introduce point mutations at various points throughout its chromosome. Okay, and then in the end, you start to get observable, measurable phenotypes in the final organism, right? Ignoring the ones that have died on the way. So you have flies that are bigger, or you have flies with red eyes, or you have flies with extra legs, and you have things like this going on. So if you want to know which part of the DNA is controlling a certain phenotype, what geneticists do is the following thing. So you mutagenize, you see a whole population of flies with different phenotypes. You pick a phenotype you're interested in, let's say the red eye phenotype. Now remember, that fly has mutations all through its DNA. And so you have to ask which of those mutations, or is it the combination somehow that led to this red eye phenotype? In order to figure this out, what geneticists do is they do something called backcrossing. You take this fly genome, which has a huge number of mutations, and then you cross it, you mate it back with the original fly, which is the reference state, so it has no mutations. Okay? And so what happens is then you select from those offspring the ones that still have the phenotype, and then you backcross again. And through this process, what you do is you end up, you can see this if you think it through, you end up, if this whole thing works, you end up with a fly which has just one mutation somewhere, because you've been crossing it back with the unmutated ancestor, but it still has the phenotype, because that's how you've been selecting them and tracking. Okay? And that's how you find, and so once you have a particular position on the DNA, wonderful techniques where you can just sequence that region, and once you sequence it, you know the sequence of the protein, you can actually express the protein, you can visualize it in cells by making antibodies, you can knock it down, and so on. So here's the point, okay? This whole procedure, there's no reason for it to work. So we have to think about it in the following way, okay? If there exist genes such that, right, it influences a macroscopic observable, macroscopic phenotype, you know, like height or running speed, number of legs, and so on. One macroscopic phenotype without perturbing others. Okay, that's part one. And two, okay, its influence, okay, does not depend on the alleles at distant loci, then the standard genetics will discover these genes. So I'm going to step back and say the whole thing again. So the way genetics works is exactly this way. So you generate mutations, then you backcross with recombinations, then you keep selecting the phenotype that you're interested in. Eventually you get a fly with just one mutation from the background, which has the phenotype you want. It's surprising this whole thing works at all, but that means that at least that particular gene influences eye color on its own. And also the fact that it influences eye color does not depend on the particular ones and zeros that existed throughout the rest of the genome. Okay? So if this whole thing exists, then genetics can discover these genes. And the way to think about that here, right, part one of this whole Again, if it influences one microscopic phenotype without perturbing others, if there's one gene whose mutations will change the running speed, but not height, seems shocking, but suppose there was such a gene. Or if there was some other gene that influenced height, but not running speed. And if the influence of these genes does not depend on the rest of the chromosome, genetics will discover them. Yes?
Can crossing occur at any point?
No, so it's typically homologous. It occurs at corresponding points on the genome. But I
but then that's some other assumption.
So yeah, well, so it's...
Absolutely.
So I'm sort of assuming that you always inherit all the genes, you just inherit different flavors of them. This is what I mean by obvious. Yes, Boris.
So strictly speaking, your backcrossing procedure did not show that your allele is independent of the background, just changes color on the background of your original slide.
Of the ancestor. However, the fact that you discovered it in a highly mutagenized individual and then discovered it back, in some sense, it's an independent background. So in this... Okay, so at the moment, excuse me. So at the moment, this is a tautology. Okay, if these genes exist, genetics will discover them. Point about this talk is that huge numbers of genes of this kind exist. Okay, and once you've discovered a gene, you get so much power over it that biologists can keep on. We've not even saturated what we can do by this simple procedure. Okay. So the main points that I'm going to make over here are the following. One, such genes really do exist. There's many of them. There's many, and we can just keep on going and discovering. Okay? And two, why do they exist? And three, how does this come about mechanistically? And at this point, it's useful to introduce a metaphor which is borrowed from computer science. Okay. So think about what this means. I have a code. I have some microscopic observable output. And I'm really talking about the map between the code and what's happening on the outside. So I like to think about images and the way images are stored on your computer. Okay. So you have an image file, which is some set of ones and zeros. Okay. And as it happens, there are many, many different standards for encoding images. And each one is used in a different context, and sort of obvious why, not unrelated to this talk. You can think about your highly compressed JPEG images. Or one can think about bitmaps. I'll explain what these things are. Or you can think about vector graphics. Right? What do these things mean? All these things generate images. Okay. So using any of these techniques, you can encode. So this is supposed to be a picture on your computer screen. You can encode an image which, for example, consists of a square with 8 dots. And all of them can do the same thing. The difference between these different encoding systems can really be seen, in some sense, when you make a mutation to the file that lies beneath them. Okay? So what happens when you mutate? When you mutate these three identical images by changing some 1 to 0 in the file that was on top. So can everybody see down here? Yeah? Okay. So this is important, so I hope that preserve it through the talk. When you mutate a JPEG image, JPEG, remember, is a highly compressed image format. Okay, it's efficient. So what happens when you mutate is that you tend to get a sort of degradation of the entire image. The mutation cannot be localized onto some obvious visual aspect of the final image. Okay? When you mutate a bitmap, the result is a lot easier. A bitmap, like the name suggests, one bit over here maps to some sort of pixel on the black and white image. So when you mutate a bitmap, you might get a black bit where there was a white one on the outside. Okay? And finally, vector graphics. In vector graphics, this is the most These are the largest files, given the size of the image. It's a highly inefficient code in that sense. But the primitives, when you describe a vectorographic file, are curves, sizes of curves, and so on. So these are sort of macroscopic things we're interested in. So you can imagine that when you mutate one bit in a vectorographics file, you get a square, but it's larger. Okay, it's something that's very different than what happens. So let's say it has four dots on each side. Okay? So, what I'm saying here is that the way mutations and recombination manifest themselves, mutations at the underlying genotype manifest themselves through a complicated decoding procedure, which I won't discuss, in the observable, microscopic, selectable phenotype. It's not like a JPEG image. Okay? It's not that there's some crazy map you don't know. You make one mutation, it changes everything. You know, the fly, you can't fly, it has six heads, it walks upside down. No, it maps to one thing. It has a feature which is useful to call transparency in map. Transparent maps. Right, so in some sense, bitmaps, and in a different way, vector graphics maps, are transparent maps. There's some obvious interpretation for what's going on down here in the way in which they influence the final outcome. That's much more so for vector graphics, where we build them to encode things we're interested in. The sizes of curves, the shapes of curves, how many curves there are, and so on. So the macroscopics are directly encoded over here. In bitmaps, it's a little more simple encoding, obviously. It's one bit, one bit. Maybe this doesn't change some feature of the image we're interested in, but at least it's a transparent code. But it's not like JPEG. So why is it that the standard tricks of genetics are able to uncover a huge number of genes involved in a huge number of really interesting phenotypes of intellectual and of medical relevance? It's saying somehow that most of the maps between genotype and phenotype look like these vector graphics maps, and they don't look like JPEGs. Maybe they look like bitmaps. So what I'm going to do over the next, with the rest of the talk, is really show you, yes, so such genes really do exist. How do we know they exist? How do we know they exist independent of discovery bias and so on? And then spend all my time telling you, speculations on why they exist. Now this should be surprising to everybody. Right? So as long as you can encode an image, there's no reason to discriminate between how you encode them. Yeah?
You said most of the maps because you can't actually discover.
You can't discover. Right. So absolutely. So of course. So I'm saying so if these genes exist, we'll discover them. Right? So it's true. So and what you're saying is these are the only ones we're going to discover, so this talk is somehow in some sense without content.
In a nice way. How many it is relative to the total number?
Yeah. So this is a very good question. How would we discover multi-locus traits? How do we discover things that depend on background in complicated ways?
Maybe you can answer that question if you just say that we're able to discover a certain percentage of the genes in this way of an organism, and we quantify the total number, and therefore we can.
Yeah. So I'll say it differently. I don't know what the percentage is. Okay. In fact, when I get to the end of the talk, so this is precisely the frontier at which standard genetics just runs into a block. Okay. And if you don't have simple things like this, then you have to start using more sophisticated methods to discover what's going on. Now, I don't want to talk about the percentage of genes that work in this way. But here's what's true. Every phenotype that I've come across, right, some has a gene underneath that works like this. Right? So that gives biologists, so you discover, okay, skeptical looks, but fine. So you can discover, and I'll give you a few examples. I'll give you a few examples, okay? Some new results. So if your goal is to discover particular molecules that are involved in particular processes and not outline everything involved in that process, and then to perturb that process using chemical inhibitors or RNA interference or whatever it is, once you discover the gene, you have that power, right? These simple genes give you power to perturb the underlying systems. So I don't know what percentage of all genes they are, but it's a large percentage of all phenotypes.
How do you feel about the fact that those mappings are probably rarely, if ever, one-to-one, meaning that you observe some, like red eyes and a fly, but there could be a number of different mutations that actually are realized by this outward phenotype. Mm-hmm. In fact, our ability to resolve different phenotypes is sort of just, I don't know, it's aesthetic more than anything else. It's not actually, like, some cell dies in some funny way, but you don't really know what actually mechanistically happened to lead to cell death or something like
that. Yeah, so I completely agree. So the key point is that in the absence of mechanism, you still get power to perturb and control. In the absence of knowledge of mechanism, this simple procedure still gives you power to perturb and control. So you can't resolve what the mechanism is. There are many different ways in which this could come about, but that still makes biologists very successful, right? And that somehow is the reason why you don't need to figure out mechanism, because you've already got what you wanted. But so now, to answer this kind of question, I'd have to show you some data to back up these sort of crazy claims. So that's what I'm going to do now. See if there's anything I've left out along the way. Okay, very good. So by the way, there's really two pieces, okay? So it influences one phenotype without influencing others. And the other is that the way it influences it somehow independent of a lot of other stuff that's going on in the rest of the genome. And if you think about it, the first piece is a bit like vector graphics. It influences height instead of influencing width, for example. And the second piece is a bit like bitmaps, where you influence just the left side of the image without influencing the right side of the image. Okay. So how do we know any of this is true? So the reason we can start to make statements about the existence of these genes and so on is because now, of course, we have powers that go far beyond mutagenesis and simple backcrossing and standard genetics. So it's worth saying what that is. So there is a concept. There's the notion of a single nucleotide polymorphism. So single nucleotide polymorphism. Single nucleotide means that it applies to one particular position on the DNA. Polymorphism means there's many options at that position. And what it means is if you take the human population and you compare the genomes of different individuals, then of course they'll be different at particular sites. But the vast majority of the genome is fixed. Most of it is the same, not counting changes and repeats. Okay? But there are particular places where there is a different letter at that position. For example, so this might correspond to different alleles at a given locus. So my picture here, ones and zeros, you can easily think of each one or each zero as being one example of these single nucleotide polymorphisms. Now what we've been able to do is, because of all these genome mapping projects, there's a fairly comprehensive data set of polymorphisms that occur that affect more than 2% or 5% of the population. So any locus where at least some individuals have some difference, you can record them. Okay, these are not mutants, they're just naturally occurring variations. Now what you can do is you can take an individual and instead of sequencing his or her entire genome to find out who they are, you can just look at what values they have at these single nucleotide polymorphisms. And that in some sense allows you to figure out what's going on. That is responsible for the difference between them and some other human. Mostly. Okay? So this is incredibly powerful. So you're not restricted to backcrossing and identifying a single mutation. Okay? You can just get the entire, you can find a mutant, you can just get the entire set of things that are different. It's not really true, it's not a mutation, but you can find the reason why one individual is different from another at all loci instead of backcrossing and looking at a single locus. Now these kinds of studies have recently been done. In many different organisms, but the papers that I like a lot, I have them over here. So you can do this for dog breeds. Okay. So here's very nice results. So this is a new last year and a recent paper. I think it came out last week. So what you can do in this case is you take several tens of dog breeds. I mean, there are over 100 well-defined breeds. And you take individuals from different breeds of dog. And you can classify them by saying they're short-limbed and long-limbed, that they have long fur and curly fur, and they have mustaches and eyebrows and these kinds. You know, any number of ways in which you think of classifying them. Of course, you pick the ones that breeders have tended to select over the last several thousand years. In fact, even behavioral traits. And what you can do is you can assort, you can sort out the individuals in your test into short head and long head, and then go into the single nucleotide polymorphisms, or go into the genotype and see where they are different. And you can, again, assort the short limb from the long limb, the curlies from the straights, and so on. And the amazing thing, so here's an example where you can have just the coat, that's this paper, the coat of the dog, and you can classify the coat as being coat length. Okay. And coat curliness, let's say, and then just for fun, on this side I'm putting the size of the dog, small and big. And what you find is from the association studies, you know, you just take all the dogs that have short coats and all the dogs that have long coats and find out what's similar, what can be used to classify these two groups, and then curlies and non-curlies and so on. Remember, you can have all possible combinations. What they find is there are genes. So there's a gene called FGF5. There's a gene called FGF21. Doesn't matter what these things are. These are particular places on the chromosome which seem to co-vary with these traits. Variations at this locus change just the length of the coat, but not whether it's curly or not. And it doesn't change the size of the dog. Okay, although it's a growth factor. Variations of the alleles of this gene, changing ones to zeros at this locus, will change a dog from having a smooth coat to a curly coat, at least in this association study, right, without changing the size or the length of the coat. These are just correlations. These are not cause, but one stunning example of causation correlation. Suppose you look at flies again, and you look at genes responsible for encoding the eye of the fly. There's one particular gene which is called eyeless. Unfortunately, you know that the gene is named after the thing which vanishes when you mutate it. So the eyeless gene is responsible for the eye in Drosophila. One gene, you express the eyeless gene, you cause it to cause the protein to be generated in the wing or the leg, the abdomen, and you get a whole eye in the middle of the wing, a whole eye in the middle of the leg. Okay? So this is not just correlation. There are individual genes that can control one trait without messing with the other one for many of the phenotypes that dog breeders are interested in. Okay.
You can control the existence of the trait. It's like ultravitorex and all this one, but not the creation of the trait.
Not the creation. This is absolutely. So it is in the background of a single breed or a single closely related set of species, and you're talking about small changes to microscopic traits. I'm not talking about the creation of new body plans and new species and so on. Right. Absolutely.
But doesn't this suggest that you could make essentially any
kind of
combination
dog
of these traits into a dog?
This is why I brought these amazing papers. So it absolutely works the way you would think. So I don't know if you can see this, but here's a matrix, and the blacks are where one of them has a particular allele and the other one does not, and so you have curly and straight and something else, and all possible variants of this exist, and they lead to these short and curly dogs and long and shaggy dogs and everything else. Okay, and this also suggests, by the way, that dog breeders, so this is really interesting, right? So when you breed dogs, it's not that all curly dogs were descended from one curly dog that somebody had selected a long time ago. People have been independently selecting for curliness, okay? Independently selecting for height, and so on. You could have selected the curly dog first and then made it tall, or selected the tall dog first and made it curly over thousands of years. These are the genes that process tends to pick up.
But the experience suggests that the realization in the population of dogs is nowhere close to all possible linear combinations of all.
So
is
that you should see some of these dogs. Yeah, so there I beg to differ. And by the way, you should go to a Drosophila stock center and see what kinds of stuff come up. Everything. It's quite crazy. So this looks like what? This looks like vector graphics, right? You change the length of it. Okay, now here's something which Auger's paper comes out today, I think, in PNAS. So let's look at, I don't want to get this panel on. Abzanov, so at Harvard, Oje, who's in the audience here. So they discovered the following thing. I'm talking about vector graphics, okay? So this is dogs. Now let's look at something that's much more closer to the origins of evolutionary biology, right? So you look at Darwin's finches. Okay, so this is a bit of a heavy Jay Leno kind of thing. But, now, what Oje and colleagues did, they just took photographs of the beaks of Darwin's finches, okay, and simply used scaling maps on the image, height and length, to map them onto each other. And it turns out different species, the beaks of different species, short, big, and so on, through scaling, all map, you know, far beyond any expected degree onto one curve. And in fact, if you add shear, you can map all different species. So in some sense, you take this image, you allow the height to scale, and you allow the length to scale. And then you find the best combination of scaling factors to compress all these different finch beaks onto one proto-beak. And this works shockingly well. Okay? So first of all, the way that different species, closely related species of Darwin's finches, evolved long beaks and high beaks and so on, was taking some sort of basic beak and just changing these huge, macroscopically observable things about them. That's shocking on its own. What you can do then is you can do the same kind of single nucleotide polymorphism mapping, but in this case what they did was you can go into the developing embryo and just look at the progenitors, the bones of the developing embryos that will give rise to beak, and you can see which genes are expressed there. Then you can segregate short and long beaks and high and or deep and shallow beaks and so on.
I'm sorry, what do you mean, which genes are expressed there?
Oh, but so now we have the genome of some sort of standard bird, and so we can just go in and just extract in the developing embryo a little component of that tissue, break it up, spread it over what's called a microarray, where you have complementary DNA to every particular gene that you're interested in, and then just measure which ones are high and low in those locations. It's amazing. It's outstanding. Okay, so of course it gives you a lot of data which you can't interpret in many cases. Okay? But then you can ask for the classifier genes that are high and low and short beaks and long beaks and so on. And here, and Oje tells me this is no longer completely true, but what you find, okay, is suppose I define the depth and the length, right? So I have the length of the beak and the depth, or the width, by the way, of the beak. Then changes in the expression of one protein, which is called bone morphogen protein 4, change just the depth, more or less, but not the length, and changes in the expression or activity of calmodulin, which is another completely different kind of protein, change the length, but not the depth. Okay, so this is true. This is true. It's amazing. And, you know, no matter how the fact that it's not quite orthogonal and so on, doesn't take away from the fact that changing the expression of bone morphogen protein 4 doesn't take away the ability of the bird to fly. It just changes the height of the beak at that position. Okay, this is shocking. And
But this is very interesting what you're saying for the bird reason. I mean, not actually my paper, which is not, but the BMP4 is expressed in any single tissue that you can imagine. So what you were saying in the beginning, that, oh, this is a gene actually that basically is in both in one phenotype and not in the other. This is all BMP4 is expressed everywhere.
Very good. So this is why I'm very, very glad you asked this question. So that's why I'm talking about locus and not gene. Okay? There are two ways to change what a gene does. You can make a mutation in the gene, or you can make a mutation out here which says where and when during development it is expressed. Okay? So changes in bone morphogen protein 4 in the beak are not due to mutations that map to the gene. They're due to mutations that map to the rule about where the gene is expressed, but it's still a single point which you can change. Okay? That's why I talk about locus more generally than gene. Boris.
Never mind.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I have a question.
You keep saying site. Are these genes too?
These ones and zeros?
These regulatory areas.
Oh, no. They're not called genes technically because they don't encode proteins. But changes in them do. It's just the definition. Okay. But changes in them do lead to changes in phenotype. So they're not called genes. It's better to talk about locus, which can apply to genes or regulators or off-sites.
Okay.
So you say this is shocking, but is there a sense in which evolution acts most effectively?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is what I'm getting at. So it's not shocking when you think about it. But yeah, I'll so this can be taken and made into a rigorous statement. Sorry. Yeah.
This is something that bothers me. Were all these finches photographed in profile?
Yes.
I mean, I'm just wondering, does that mean that there's a third gene that no one noticed because they weren't?
So it turns out that the width and the length are strongly correlated. The width and the depth are strongly correlated to this gene, but the length is strongly correlated to this one. So somehow these two change together, and this one changes independently. Right? And if you think about the natural history of these birds, about why they use their different beaks, there might be some method in all this madness in the back there.
Maybe this is my bias as a developmental geneticist, but why is this shocking? I mean, it doesn't seem...
Okay, it's shocking. It's shocking because, as a computer scientist, I can use a JPEG or a bitmap or vector graphics to make a perfectly good image. That's why it's shocking. Okay, so I'll get to the reasons why it's shocking in a second. But all these things give perfectly good images. Okay, that's why it's shocking.
Mukund.
Yes, Mike.
I think a lot of yeast geneticists and Drosophila geneticists, they're almost entirely focused on gene interactions these days. But another thing, maybe you don't have to answer it now, but you should keep in mind that one of the big engines of evolution is the origin of new species. And virtually everybody in that field agrees that you can't get new species with genes like this. You have to have gene interaction, because if you had one gene that came along that caused an incompatibility all by itself, it could never spread through a species.
Yeah.
There are a lot of species out there, so
yeah.
Therefore there must be a lot of genes that only make it by interactions.
So it's related to Roger's point again. So this works for small deformations of a single species, closely related species of breed. But interesting what you say, because there are groups of finches where this orthogonality works. Okay. There are other groups of finches where calmodulin on its own, correct me if I'm wrong, controls both the width, the depth, and the height of the beak. Okay, so these rules will change between different species. Yes.
So, but still the question here exists, since it's only the beaks that were photographed. Does BMP4 also affect, do they have different lengths of legs, for example?
So, right. Question arises. So not that the authors mentioned, but it's worth...
So the point is that the BMP4, the formation of the beak developmentally, it's modular. So the expression levels of the BMP4 that you get in the frontonasal mass, that is, when it develops into the beak, actually are independent from the BMP4 levels that you get in the breast of the embryo. Controlled independently.
So that's your answer. So that particular regulatory site changes.
That's theory.
Yeah. Well.
No, that's not theory.
So.
Well, I mean, at the end of the theory, I mean, it was done experimentally.
but let's keep going. So these kinds of maps are shown as vector graphics maps. You can change the height, literally the height, the depth, or something of an organism, by changing the allele at a given locus. There's a different type of map which looks like a bitmap, and you can imagine where these kinds of things arise. They arise in development. Okay. So in other words, there's a sort of amazing mapping between the full-grown, or at least the developing embryo, the organism, and its DNA. And I'll show you in the following way. This is dog. Okay. Now there's a series of genes which are called Hox genes. I hope you can see down here. Hox genes, which are they are regulators. They are transcription factors. They are the things that control whether other genes are going to be turned on and off. So you can imagine in the development of an organism, so for example, if you have a fish, there was a nice talk today where we saw a developing fish. So this is a fish embryo. Or you have, let's say, a quadruped embryo. So forgive me if I get these little things wrong. There's four little legs and developing eye. Or you have a fly embryo, which is developing some sort of... So these are things that are on their way to becoming adults. Okay. So, and different components of them will end up encoding eye, head, abdomen, legs, and so on, brain. And of course, the reason that happens is because there are regulators, there are master regulators that control the genes that are expressed in brain, and then thorax, and then leg, and so on. So there are regions where different types of genes are expressed. Now, it should not be surprising that many organisms, from flies to fish to humans, use the same regulators, because we're all descended from a common ancestor. Okay, this is not surprising. And let's call the regulators, there's different ones that are expressed in different parts of the body, right? And they're sort of expressed in a sort of linear way along from the front, the anterior to the posterior of the organism. Here's the amazing thing. If you look on the genome to see where these genes are sitting, okay, where are the genes sitting? And I've already told you, it looks like a bitmap. It really does. So on the genome, you have these five genes, for example. These five genes exist in exactly the same order. Exactly the same order on the DNA, okay, as they are expressed in the developing embryo. Now, this is shocking, because there's no explanation for this. Remember how much of a distance there is between DNA and the final organism. DNA spread out, make the proteins. Proteins interact. They go away, make cells. Cells talk to each other. Okay, the different cells will stick to each other. Tissues will grow. Finally, you get the organism. Okay? And the fact is, there are species where you break this ordering. It doesn't change. It doesn't stop them from being, from developing. Okay? There are places where this sort of what's called collinearity doesn't happen. Nevertheless, in a huge number of cases, the Hox genes have a bitmap kind of mapping. Right? In other words, you can sort of imagine a recombination event where an organism exchanges the alleles for the anterior, not the posterior, and you end up with a different front and not a different back. Okay? So this is very nice. And finally, something which I actually worked on with Boris, there are proteins called polyketide synthases. This is in bacteria. Right? Here we sort of have an explanation, but we'll see. So in this case, again, I'm going to describe a linear map. In this case, it's not between an embryo, because bacteria are single-celled organisms. But inside the bacterial cell, there are protein complexes which form. And they form in chains. Okay? You have proteins which stick together. Protein A sticks to protein B, B sticks to C, C sticks to D, and so on. And they do something. Okay? They actually make antibiotics to kill other bacteria. Okay. And if you look, and that will be important in just a second, because I'm about to wrap up. If you look at where their genes are sitting, it's exactly, that should be E, it's exactly in the same order. Okay. Although you can change this order and nothing happens up here. So there's a surprising mapping between the order in which proteins interact and the order in which they're encoded in the genome. It's a bitmap kind of mapping. Okay, so I'm done with the data. So now just to wrap up, I'm going to...
You said that you could change the order down
here, and it doesn't. So since all the genes are still expressed, they still make all the proteins. The proteins all know who to interact with, so they still make the correct ABCDE protein chain, and everything is fine for the organelle. Right? Nevertheless, this structure is retained in the genome. It has no functional implication whatsoever. Right? You can change it from a JPEG type map to a BMP type map, and you still get the same image. It's surprising. Yes.
Maybe all the non-viable organisms are expressing the JPEG like map.
Yeah. Well, so it's not that easy, but okay. So we'll get to that. So I'm going to delete. So the way this talk went is, why don't you need map? Because the mappings are so clean. And now I've shown you the maps. You can agree that at least these things are sort of compelling, but it's not comprehensive. So. And now we get to your point. So why do these maps arise? Tristan.
So I guess what I was trying to say before, and Boris sort of alluded to it as well, it seems that pretty much under very few, if any, circumstances, can you actually ever say you've met condition one? And then the guy, I don't know who asked about the girl.
Yeah, because we haven't looked.
Saying it's like a, I don't want to use the term improperly, it's like an NP-hard problem. Mm-hmm. It's like something you can't, mm-hmm. you'd have to go through the entire organism and like characterize everything about it before you knew that you had met condition one.
Yeah, so this is an ansatz.
But it also must matter the degree of perturbation, right?
Sure.
Secondary.
Yeah, something that won't kill you. Somewhere else, but it does change where you are now. Okay, so let's almost wrap up here. Let's get back. So why do these maps exist? Why is genetics so successful? Evolution is a search problem in some sense. You're trying to find the best phenotype that fits your particular niche, your environment. And once you've found that phenotype, right. It really doesn't matter how you encode it. Okay, you could, as long as you have this, if your correct phenotype, if your organism was an image and the correct phenotype was this sort of 3x3 square, it doesn't matter whether you use JPEG, BMP, vector graphics encoding, you would still be just as successful. Okay? But here's the important point. Evolution is about change. Constant change. Okay? It's not that you've arrived at one point and you're happy. And the reasons are many. So you want to exploit new niches as they become available. Some island becomes colonized and then things will then diverge on the island. Right? You might want to respond to environmental changes that keep on happening. And even if these sort of external things were not changing, your competitors will keep on changing to try and get the best of you, right? So there's competition between different species and different members of the same species. Okay. So there's this phrase that you have to keep running to stay in the same place. It's called the red queen hypothesis. So it's, evolution is about change. And in this context, transparent, what I call transparent codes, are precisely the ones, right, that allow you to preserve your past achievements while trying to make changes in other places. Okay, when you're trying to move from being a short dog to a big dog, it was not to say it's trying to move there, but suppose the environment changed, that taller dogs would somehow would be better adapted to their environment. If the encoding was such that, you know, to get from being short to tall, you had to go through a six-legged stage, that that would be very difficult to do. Whereas if there was, there happened to be a gene that allowed you to change just that one phenotype, that's the one that would change. In fact, that's what our dog breeding experiments do suggest. So the point is, imagine now that I have a competing system where I have many organisms, and all of them are perfectly fit in the current environment. Okay, they're all beautiful squares. And now I change the environment where I want a bigger square. Right? Then I'll allow them to compete. Eventually, these guys are going to die out because they're not going to get by mutation and recombination to the big square state, whereas this one is. Now remember, all three are equally capable of encoding big squares as well. Okay? That's not their problem. Their problem is to go from small to big. Now, if you imagine who survives at the end of this sort of procedure, the ones that survive are those that use vector graphics. It's not that vector graphics maps are inherently more fit. What they do is they hitchhike, it's called hitchhiking, on the back of other traits, in this case height or size of the square, that does confer fitness. Okay? So this is sort of the hand-waving. This is the hypothesis. The hypothesis is that these maps exist and they're transparent because they hitchhike on the back of successful phenotypes in a constantly changing environment. Yes?
It looks like it's not just transparency, but it's also leveraging. The bitmap is transparent. It's one bit changes, one mm-hmm. dot changes. But you want something that leverages into a macroscopic trait.
So very good. So under mutation, okay, these are beautiful maps to have because you want to change one point, right? But under recombination, bitmaps are beautiful things to have because you can change the entire right part of the image without changing the left one. Okay, so of course recombination leverages for you.
You have both, actually. Right?
You have both.
And you have both because you have like Antinoporia phenotypes, like in Drosophila, which tells you there is one gene that changes there, and it changes binary, the yes. phenotype. But you have an effect like BMP4 expression that changes actually more like graded.
Yes.
So you have.
Yeah. You have all kinds, but they're all transparent.
Is it essentially it's the locality of mutation that drives this?
Yes.
So you could ask, if you increase the rate of mutation 100-fold or 1,000-fold so that things are being mutated
yes.
at different locations on the gene at the
yes.
same time
yes.
very frequently,
yes.
you get different things. In fact, you see this, there's an analogy to nuclear astrophysics. You have the S process and the P process, or R process, where you're either adding one neutron to the atom, see what happens, or you just flood it. You can get different things.
Well, so I guess the... Yeah, that's a very good point. So I don't know what we would expect if the natural processes were to generate huge numbers of mutations and that was the way of the world, if we were living on a radioactive planet.
Turns out that the Schrodinger has a book on that. It's called What
If Life? Well, yeah. Right, so well, all this is very old. By the way, I should say that a lot of this, a lot of what I've said over here is taken from a paper by Wagner and Altenburg in 1996. And they actually start their paper thinking about genetic algorithms. And they say that when people are trying to solve optimization problems in genetic algorithms. Some people are very successful and some others are not. And what makes the difference between them is what they call the representation problem, which is exactly how you represent your final outcome in terms of ones and zeros. So I should, I'm going to try and wrap up soon and take questions afterwards. Okay. So please hold on just for a second. So here's the big prediction for this. Here's the big prediction. So we can't do the experiment where you have high mutagenesis and you see what kinds of maps evolve. But we can do the following experiment, which is happening all the time. If you have a fruit fly, which is a model organism, everybody wants to study the same organism, and so it's propagated with constant selective pressure. It's propagated in a fixed environment for thousands of generations in thousands of labs around the world. Okay? So what you would expect is, in fixed environments, it doesn't matter what kinds of map you use. And so you would sort of expect, after some amount of time, which might be very, very long, that the transparency of the map would degrade, but the fitness of the organism would not. So that's a prediction, and you can sort of see how that works out. Okay, so finally, to wrap up. Where's all my help? Ah, here. So such genes do exist. Why do they exist? Somehow to do with the fact that evolution keeps changing, and so clean maps allow you so evolution drives organisms to keep changing, and clean maps are the ones that will hitchhike on the back of successful phenotypes. How does this come about? Okay, this is where we all work. I mean, all the people who are engaged in modeling what happens at the molecular level, but where we work is at the level of mechanism. Okay? It's not enough that we know the list of 1,000 genes that are responsible for this process or that one and so on. Okay, although that gives you power to perturb. We want to know how this connection from genotype to phenotype comes about. And this is where, of course, this entire argument breaks down, because whatever works is what's going to happen for mechanism. Right? So I think that's where, obviously it's not that mathematics would be ineffective here. Mathematics would be most effective exactly here, whereas it was completely not required from the front to the back. Okay, so to finish. By the way, if anybody's interested, so I wish somebody had asked me, but this linear protein chain, linear DNA, there's a sort of trivial map in which you can do a sort of bitmap type encoding. But suppose you have more complicated protein interaction chains and you wanted to encode them on linear DNA, can that be done? Can that not be done? So if you ask me a question about that later, I'll answer it. So, fine. So the genes that standard genetics finds easily are precisely the ones that natural selection can operate on. Therefore, there are lots of genes, lots of transparent maps. Right? And that's why geneticists have been so successful at making parts lists for components involved in all kinds of processes that we find very, very, very interesting. And I think what's left for us to do, not what's left, but like the next step is to actually find out how come these mappings are so clean, how they work, and that will complete this story. So that's it. Thank you.
So we'll have questions first from people not in the program, because they have plenty of chances.
That's me. We learned a few weeks ago from Dr. Lynch, right, that and at the level of population, small population, genetic drift was a much more important mechanism for moving evolution along than any of the two which you mentioned here. Further, he made the remarkable assertion that there was no evidence whatsoever that a trait like multicellularity was in any way adaptive. So, how would that relate to the existence of such maps in bacteria?
Okay, so I'll answer the first part first, the genetic drift. So, what Mike Lynch said applies completely to what I've been talking about here. Just because there's a way to change the outward phenotype by making a mutation does not at all guarantee that that individual, which has a slight fitness advantage, that organism's offspring are going to be the ones that eventually take over the population. Okay? The probability of that happening depends completely on population genetic force. Okay? What this does is it reduces the number of lethal mutations and sort of increases the prefactor to that question. But population, genetic drift is the thing that eventually will determine whether you will take over or not. Okay. The second piece, remind me, what was the question?
So, second piece is, there, if I understood him correctly, right, he's here and he can explain it, right, there's a lot of evidence that there are traits that are manifested that are not responsible to any of the three things on your list.
Right. Right. traits that are not adaptive, for example, multicellularity, by the numbers, is clearly not adaptive.
Well, he can correct me.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So I'm not sure how it would fit in here. So, of course, I've been talking about traits that eventually do, that selection can act upon. I think one of the points that Mike made is that the reason some sort of feature of the genome or the mapping or anything else comes up initially can be different from the ways in which natural selection exploits it later. Okay. So the reason, for example, that you have all these proteins in a chain, genes in a line, probably is because of initial gene duplication. And later, this sort of organization allowed selection to act upon it in this way that will preserve a transparent map. Okay. So I think that was one of Mike's main points, that you shouldn't come up with adaptive explanations for everything you see, because the reason it came up in the first place could be different from why it eventually confers fitness. Is that about...
Well, there were a lot of points raised, so I guess the last point you were making is fine.
Okay. So other people not in the brain.
Right, so back to the finch beak size thing. So let's just postulate for the sake of argument some gene where if the beak is going to be extremely long and thin or short and stout, it would prevent it from being so, because you know such a thing existed and the fish might not survive. So in other words, there might be some gene that controls these other things that would tend to survive from natural selection. So from this experiment, that wouldn't
test for what to come up.
Because the population of finches probably is, you know, some generic.
Yeah, it's so there's no variation in that particular.
Right, so is there some other way that you might test for such a thing?
Mechanism. You should come up with a model of how it works and then see if there's interesting gaps, the unique players that you need that are missing in the list of genes that you have, and then go look for that by staining, by looking at images, and so on.
It seems a lot harder than
that. Yeah. So I'm not saying that this at all saturates the number of genes involved in anything like that. A question from non-programmed, not
kind of led to the second point there, which is, I mean, I would guess that, I mean, you described essentially local genes. If there were genes that were some reflection of collective behavior, you'd expect them to be precisely those ones that are not adaptive, right? Because either you're left alone or you die.
Yeah, there's this idea that
change one bit of a three-bit system.
There's an idea that you don't, right? What they call pleiotropic interactions, is something, the behavior of something depends on many other things, are very hard to change, and they tend to be more or less constant in the population.
Are there a large number of those? Or, I mean, there was the earlier question, but is many also the same as most?
No, it's not most at all. There's many in the sense that we can keep doing biology like this for a long time without biologists coming and saying, now I need to learn math. That's what many mean. Yeah, I hope this is not
So it seems to me that a lot of controversy in what you said, so aside from so the statement mathematics is irrelevant, which is in this audience roughly saying, you know, speaking against motherhood and fine. But a lot of the controversy sort of goes back to a question that was raised, the difference between some and most. Because one way, especially for the physicists in the audience, of understanding what you described is that there are some phenotypes and some genes, okay, I'm sorry, there are some phenotypes that are easy to evolve. And so these are sort of like low-lying excitations.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that all excitations are low-lying, it's just that there are some.
Absolutely.
And you have a way that you described, so for that matter, genetics has a way of pulling out these low-lying excitations, and in fact, dog breeders do just that. I mean, there's a reason why they...
But they don't have six-legged dogs, for example.
Yeah. Or dogs laying eggs or something, right? Because, you know, why do they breed, you know, curly hair? Quick answer is because they can.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so by discovering, you know, the set of dimensions that they can easily breed, you're basically taking a biased sample of all the genes, all the alleles that they can be. And then, of course, it's still amazing and very pleasing.
No, but
and going back to the fact that these low-lying sort of easy modes actually exist.
No, it's not just that they exist, that these low-lying modes, these easy directions, are precisely the ones natural selection can also act upon, the ones that geneticists can find.
By definition.
Yes, exactly. That was not by definition at the start. Not by definition of the start, but precisely the same thing. So they will provide insight into biology, which is what we've been learning. Most of the biology we know was discovered through genes like this. right? Amazing biology. We discovered through genes like this. So apart from being low-lying, it's taken us to a level where we can start to ask other questions. But really, you shouldn't knock what biology has given us so far using just this. Mike.
So I have an observation. It just seems completely opposite to what you're saying. Maybe I'm misinterpreting, but beginning of last century, there was this thing that became known as the modern synthesis, population genetics. And all that theory that was developed, we still use today, it's great developments, all that was focused on was genes of completely additive effects, the kind of genes that you're talking about. This was a big bolus of mathematics and biology. It got made fun of by some people like Ernst Mayr, who called this beanbag genetics. To be honest, I think a lot of biologists don't like, are paranoid about mathematics. That's the main reason. If you're not, you go into physics, I guess. But the point that Mayr made was the reason all this theory was irrelevant, I think it's a protective mechanism, but he argued that everything is interaction. And I think you're arguing that everything is interactions. That's where the mathematics comes in. And Mayr argued exactly the opposite thing. If everything's interactions, forget the math. Am I?
No, you're absolutely right. So in the way that things are decoded, obviously everything's interactions. How do you go from here to here? You have to work through this whole mess of actually growing an organism, working your way through, and having your influence felt as a gene. Right? The fact that such thing maps exist at all is something that begs to be explained. How do you generate the thing maps when underneath there's a lot of interactions going on? So there's an effective theory of free particles, and underneath there's a lot of interactions, and there's a reason. And we'll figure this out. But both of them.
It just seems like a different reaction. I think you're saying if there's more interactions, then there's more reason to do math. Whereas my experience in population genetics, people have used that as exactly the argument for not using math because it's hopeless.
But I want to finish with this and close up. It's not that biologists don't do math because they're opposed to math. If biology required mathematics,
not biophysicists, obviously.
If biologists required mathematics to be great biologists, they would learn mathematics. It's not that you get a bunch of architects who are scared of using computers, because you just have to use computers. Okay? So biologists, for the moment, are not restricted by these mathematical models, and that's why they don't use them. But they still discover great biology. Okay, thank you.
Can you ask a last question? Suppose you are a crocodile egg, and you know, if it's grown at, I forgot which temperature, you become a female.
Yes.
Now you change temperature by 3 degrees Celsius, and you become a male. Would you say that temperature is a gene? I mean, how does that impact on all what you said?
We can have this discussion later. So, yeah, I won't answer that now. I think it's not finished. It works through something else.
The genes have to be defined, right? There are all those parameters which are not these spontaneous parameters, but continuously changing parameters. It means that the level of expression matters, not only whether it's expressed or
not. Of course, by changing these things, you change that.
Yeah, but that's a too complex thing.
Of course.
Well, let's think. Thank you.